Chapter 31. Cerberus Hades, Delta Pavonis Heliopause, 2566.
I think this calls for a cigarette, Volyova said, and for a moment she had to remember where she had last stowed the smokes. When she found them in a little visited pocket of her flying jacket, she did not rush either to open the pack or fish out one of the crumpled, yellowing tubes which resided within. She took her time, and when at last she was ready, she took an unhurried inhalation and allowed her nerves to settle, like a blizzard of feathers slowly returning to the ground.
The ship killed him, she said,
staring down at the remnants of Hegazi, but doing her best not to think too hard about what she was looking at.
That's the only thing that makes sense.
Killed him?
Kuri asked, still directing the barrel of her plasma rifle at the elements of the Triumvir, which floated in suspension in the slick of ship slime around their feet, as if nervous that his disassociated remains might be on the verge of spontaneously reassembling.
You mean this wasn't an accident?
No, it wasn't an accident. I know he was in league with Sajaki, and therefore Sylvest, yet Sunstealer still killed him.
Makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess it does.
Perhaps Kuri had already worked it out for herself, but Volyova decided to spell it out anyway.
Sylvest is gone. He's on his way to Cerberus. And because I didn't manage to sabotage the weapon, there'll be very little to stop him getting inside. Do you understand? It means Sunstealer has won. Nothing remains for him to achieve. The rest is only a question of time, and of maintaining the status quo.
And what threatens that?
We do,
Kuri said hesitantly, like a clever pupil who wanted to impress teacher but not draw the derision of her classmates.
More than that, not just you and I, not even when we include Pascal. Hegazi was also a threat, as far as Sunstealer was concerned, and for no other reason than that he was human.
She was guessing, of course, but it seemed to make complete sense to her.
To something like Sunstealer, human loyalty is fluid and chaotic, maybe not even properly comprehensible. He'd turned Hegazi, or at the very least those to whom Hegazi was already loyal. But did he understand the dynamics which governed that loyalty? I doubt it. Hegazi was a component which had served its usefulness, and which might malfunction at some point in the future.
She felt the icy calm which came from contemplating her own oblivion, knowing that there were few times when she had ever been so close to it.
So he had to die. And now that his objective is almost achieved, I think Sunstealer will want to do the same to all of us.
If he wanted to kill us,
he'd already have done so? He may well have already tried, Kuri.
Whole parts of the ship are no longer under any central control, which means that Sunstealer is limited in what he can do. He's taken possession of a body already half paralyzed, already half leprous and half afflicted with the palsy.
Very poetic, but what does it mean to us then?
Volyova lit another cigarette. She had thoroughly seen off the first of them.
It means he will try and kill us, but that his options are difficult to predict. He can't simply depressurize the whole ship, since there are no command channels which allow for that. Even I couldn't do it, other than by physically opening all the locks, and to do that I'd have to disable thousands of electromechanical safeties. He would probably find it difficult to flood an area larger than the airlock, but he will think of something, I'm sure of it.
Suddenly, and it was almost without thinking, she had the slug gun in her hands and she was pointing it down the dark lengths of the flooded corridor which led to the lock.
What is it?
Nothing, Volyova said. I'm just scared. Remarkably so. I don't suppose you have any suggestions, Kuri.
She did, as a matter of fact.
We'd better find Pascal.
She doesn't know her way around as well as we do. And if it gets nasty...
Volyova stubbed out what was left of her cigarette, mashing it against the barrel of the slug gun.
You're right. We should stay together. And we will. Just as soon as...
Something emerged noisily from the gloom and halted 10 meters from them. Volyova had the gun on it immediately, but she did not fire. Some instinct was telling her that the thing had not come to kill them, or at least not yet. It was one of the tracked servitors, which she had seen Sylvest using in the aborted operation to heal the captain, one of the units lacking any great internal sophistication, one of those, in short, which was primarily controlled by the ship, rather than its own brain. Its chunkily mounted sensor eyes locked onto them.
"It's not armed,"
Volyova breathed, realizing as she did so that whispering was useless.
"I think it's just been sent to scout us out. This is one of the parts of the ship which the ship can't see into, one of its blind spots."
The servitor's sensors made little swiveling motions from side to side, as if triangulating their exact positions. Then it began to reverse back into the gloom.
Kuri shot it.
"Why did you do that?"
Volyova asked, when the concussive echoes of the blast had died down, and she no longer had to squint against the glare of the machine's demise.
"Whatever it saw was already transmitted back to the ship. Shooting it was pointless."
"I didn't like the way it was looking at me," Kuri said. Then she frowned.
"And besides, it's one less we have to worry about."
"Yes," Volyova said, "and given the speed at which the ship can manufacture a drone that simple, it may be 10 or 20 seconds before it's replaced."
Kuri looked at her as if she'd just said a joke with an impenetrable punchline, but Volyova was serious. What she had just noticed had chilled her far more deeply than the appearance of the servitor. It was, after all, logical that the ship would soon resort to the drones for its sense-gathering operations. Logical, too, that it would explore ways to outfit the machines for the murder of the remaining human crew and passengers. It was something she would have predicted herself, sooner or later. But not this. Not what had just poked itself above the ooze of the ship slime. For the instant it took its black rodent eyes to spot her, before turning tail and swimming into the darkness. Ship controlled the janitor rats, she remembered. When consciousness returned, and for a moment Sylvester did not remember precisely when it had left, he was surrounded by an audience of blurred stars. They were doing a very complex dance, and if he had not already felt nauseous, he felt sure that sight alone would have been sickening. What was he doing here? And why did he feel so strange? So much as if cotton wool had been pressed into every cell in his body. Because he was in a suit. That was why. One of the special suits which the crew owned. Of the sort which had carried him and Pascal up from the surface of Resurgam. The suit had forced his lungs to accept the fluid it filled itself with instead of air.
"What's happening?"
he sub-vocalized, in the way he knew that the suit would be able to read, via the simple speech-centered trawl built into its helmet.
"I'm reversing," the suit informed him. "Midpoint thrust inversion. Where the hell are we?"
Picking through his memories was still arduous, like finding the end of a tangled rope. He had no idea where to begin.
"More than 1,000,000 kilometers from the ship. Somewhat less than that distance from Cerberus."
"We've come all that way, so..."
He stopped.
"No, wait. I've no idea how long it's been."
"We departed 74 minutes ago."
Hardly more than an hour, Sylvester thought. Yet if the suit had told him it had been a day, he would have accepted it unquestioningly.
"Our average acceleration was 10 G's. I was instructed to make all haste by Triumvir Sajaki."
Yes.
Now he remembered more. Sajaki's midnight call, and then the hurried rush to the suits. He remembered leaving a message for Pascal, though not the details. That had been his only concession. The one luxury he permitted himself. Yet even if there had been days to prepare for the entry, there would have been very little that he could have changed. He had no requirements for extra documentation or recording apparatus, since he had access to the suit's libraries and integral sensors. The suits were armed, he knew, and capable of defending themselves autonomously, against much the same modes of attack which Volyova's weapon was now experiencing. They were also able to extrude scientific analysis tools, or create compartments in themselves for the storing of samples. Quite apart from that, they were as independent as any spacecraft. He realized with a snap that he was thinking wrongly. The suits were actually spacecraft, just very flexible spacecraft and with room inside for only one occupant. Spacecraft which became their own atmospheric shuttles and, if needed, their own surface rovers. Rationally, there was no other way he would rather be entering Cerberus.
"I'm glad I slept through that acceleration," Sylvester said. You had no choice, the suit said, evincing a complete lack of interest. Consciousness was suppressed. Now please ready yourself for the deceleration phase. When you resume wakefulness, we will have arrived in the vicinity of our destination.
Sylvester began to frame a question in his head, intending to ask the suit why Sajaki had not yet shown himself, despite his assurance that he would accompany Sylvester. Yet, before he had even begun to concretize his thoughts into the unspoken state which the troll could read, the suit made him sleep again, as dreamlessly as before. While Curie went to find Pascal Sylvester, Volyova made her way back up to the bridge. Now she dared not take the elevators, but thankfully there were fewer than 20 levels to climb, an exertion, but bearable. It was also relatively safe. The ship could not send drones into the stairwells, she knew, not even the floating machines which rode through the normal corridors on superconducting magnetic fields. All the same, she kept the slug gun at readiness, sweeping it ahead of her as she endlessly rounded the ascending spiral, occasionally stopping and holding her breath, listening for the sounds of things following her, or lurking some distance ahead. On the way up, she tried to think of the myriad ways in which the ship could kill her. It was an interesting intellectual challenge, testing her knowledge of the vessel in a way she had not previously considered. It made her look at things in a new light. Once, not so very long ago, she had been in much the same position as the ship was now. She had wanted to kill Nagorny, or at the very least prevent him from becoming a threat to her, which practically amounted to the same thing. In the end she had killed him because he first tried to kill her, but it was the manner of his execution that preyed on her mind now. She had killed Nagorny by accelerating and decelerating the ship so fiercely that he had been pulped alive. Sooner or later, and she could think of no pressing reason why it should not be the case, the ship would surely think of that for itself. When that happened, it would be a very good idea not to be in the ship any more. She reached the bridge unhindered, although that did not stop her checking every shadow for a lurking machine, or, worse now, rat. She did not know what the rats could do to her, but she was less than minded to find out. The bridge was empty, much as when she had left it. The damage Curie had wrought on it was still there. Even the staining of Sajaki's blood on the floor of the vast spherical meeting place. The hollow display was still aglow, looming over her with its constantly updating progress report on the establishment of the Cerberus bridgehead. For a moment she could not help but take a proprietorial interest in her creation, which was still gamely holding its own against the antibiotic forces deployed by the alien world. Yet even as she experienced a flush of pride, she willed it to fail, so that Sylvester would be denied entry, assuming that he had not already arrived.
"What have you come for?" asked a voice.
She whipped around, and there was a figure looking down at her from one of the curved levels of the bridge. It was no one she recognized, just a darkly cloaked male with clasped hands and a sunken skull of a face. She blasted it, but the figure remained, even after the slug gun's discharges had ripped through it, ion trails lingering in the air like banners. Another figure, differently dressed, had appeared next to it. "Your tenancy here has expired," it said, in the oldest variant of Norte, Volyova's processing of it so tardy that she did not immediately understand his words.
"You must understand, Triumvir, that this domain is no longer yours," said another, shivering to life on the chamber's opposite side,
clad in the body section of a fantastically ancient spacesuit, ribbed with cooling lines and boxy attachments. The language he spoke was the oldest strain of Russish she could pass.
"What do you hope to achieve here?" asked the first figure,
even as another appeared next to it and began talking to her, and another, figures from the past hectoring her from all sides.
"This is outrageous."
But the voice blurred into that of another ghost, speaking to her from her right.
"Lack a mandate here, Triumvir, I have to tell you.
Gravely exceeded your authority and must now submit to.
Bitterly disappointed, Ilya, and must politely request that you
rescind privileges.
Completely unacceptable!"
She screamed as the welter of voices became a constant, wordless roar. the congregation of the dead filling the chamber totally, until all she could see in any direction was a mass of ancient faces, their mouths moving as if each one were the only one speaking, as if each imagined that he had her absolute attention. It was as if they were praying to her, as if they thought she was omniscient, praying, but at the same time complaining. Carpingly at first, as if disappointed, but, with every second, with more hate and scorn, as if she had not only let them down in the bitterest way possible, but that she had also committed some atrocity so dire it was unspeakable even now, but could only be acknowledged in the curved revulsion of their lips and the naked shame in their eyes. She hefted the gun. The temptation to empty a slug clip into the ghosts was overwhelming. She could not kill them, of course, but she could seriously disable their projection systems. But she needed to conserve her ammo now that the Warchive was inaccessible.
"Go away!" she shouted. "Get away from me!"
One by one the dead grew silent and vanished. As each departed, each shook its head disappointedly, as if ashamed of staying in her presence a moment longer. Finally she had the room to herself. She was breathing in hard rasps and needed to calm down. She lit another cigarette and smoked it slowly, trying to give her mind a few minutes' rest. She palmed the gun, glad she had not wasted the clip, for all the transient pleasure it would have given her to destroy the bridge. Curry had chosen well. Emblazoned along the gun's flanks were silver and gold Chinese dragon motifs. A voice spoke from the display. Volyova looked up into the face of Sun Stealer. It was as she had known it must be, after Pascal had first told her the significance of the creature's name. As she had known it must be, and yet also much worse, because she was not simply seeing how the alien looked. She was seeing how the alien looked to itself, and there was evidently something very wrong with Sun Stealer's mind. She thought back to Nagorny, and understood how the man had been driven mad. She could hardly blame him now, not if he had lived with this thing in his head all that time, and yet had lacked an inkling of where it came from or what it wanted from him. No. She sympathized with the dead gunnery officer, the poor, poor bastard. Perhaps she, too, would have sunk into psychosis when faced with this apparition, looming behind every dream, every waking thought. Once Sunstealer might have been Amarantin, but he had changed, perhaps deliberately, through the selective pressure of genetic engineering, sculpting himself and his banished brethren into a new species entirely. They had reshaped their anatomy for flight in zero gravity, grown immense wings. She could see those wings now, looming behind the curved, sleek head which seemed to thrust down towards her. The head was a skull. The eye sockets were not exactly vacant, not exactly hollow, but seemed abrim with reservoirs of something infinitely black and infinitely deep, as dark and depthless as she imagined the membrane of a shroud. The bones of Sunstealer shone with colorless luster. "Despite what I said earlier," she said, when the initial shock of what she was seeing had passed, or at least subdued to a point where she could tolerate it, "I think you could have found a way to kill me by now, if that was what you wanted."
"You cannot guess what I want."
When he spoke, there was just a wordless absence which somehow made sense, as if carved from silence. The creature's complex jawbones did not move at all. Speech, she remembered of the Amarantin, had never been an important mode of communication. Their society had been based around visual display. Something so basic would surely have been preserved, even after Sunstealer's flock had departed Resurgium and commenced their transformations. Transformations so radical that when they later returned to the world, they would be mistaken for winged gods.
"I know what you don't want," Volyova said. "You don't want anything to stop Sylvester reaching Cerberus. That's why we have to die now, in case we find a way to stop him."
"His mission is of great importance to me," Sunstealer said, then seemed to reconsider. To us who survive."
Survived what? Maybe this would be her one and only chance to come to any understanding.
"No, wait. What else could you have survived but the death of the Amarantin? Is that what it was?
Did you somehow find a way not to die?
You know by now the place where I entered Sylvest.
It was less a question, more a flat statement. Volyova wondered to how much of their discourse Sunstealer had been privy.
It had to be Lascaille's shroud, she said. That was the only thing that made sense, although not much, I admit.
That was where we sought sanctuary, for 990,000 years.
The coincidence was too great not to mean something.
Ever since life ended on Resurgam.
Yes.
The word trailed off into a hiss of sibilance.
The shrouds were of our designing, the last desperate enterprise of our flock, even after those who stayed behind on the surface were incinerated.
I don't understand. What Lascaille said, and Sylvest himself found out.
They were not shown the truth. Lascaille was shown a fiction, her identity replaced by that of a much older culture, utterly unlike ourselves. The true purpose of the shrouds was not revealed to him. He was shown a lie which would encourage others to come.
Volyova could see how that lie would have worked now. Lascaille had been told that the shrouds were repositories for harmful technologies, things humanity secretly craved, such as methods of faster-than-light travel. When Lascaille had revealed this to Sylvest, it had only increased Sylvest's desire to break into the shroud. He had been able to muster the support of the entire Demarchist society around Yellowstone towards that goal, for the rewards would be dazzling beyond comprehension for the first faction to unlock such alien mysteries.
But if it was a lie, she said, what was the true function of the shrouds?
We built them to hide inside, Triumvir Volyova.
It seemed to be playing with her, enjoying her confusion.
They were places of sanctuary, zones of restructured space-time within which we could shelter.
Shelter from whom?
The ones who survived the Dawn War. The ones who were given the name of the Inhibitors.
She nodded. There was much she did not understand, but one thing was now clear to her. What Curie had told her, the fragments that the woman remembered from the strange dream she had been vouchsafed in the gunnery, had been something like the truth. Curie had not remembered everything, and the parts had not always been related to Volyova in the right order. But it was obvious now that this was only because Curie had been expected to grasp something too huge, too alien, too apocalyptic, for her mind to comfortably hold. She had done her best, but her best had not been good enough. But now Volyova was being accorded disclosure of parts of the same picture, although from an oddly different perspective. Curie had been told about the Dawn War by the Mademoiselle, who had not wanted Sylvest to succeed. Yet Sunstealer desired that outcome more than anything else.
What is it about? She asked.
I know what you're doing here. You're delaying me, keeping me waiting because you know I'll do anything to hear the answers you have. And you're right, in a way. I have to know. I have to know everything. Sunstealer waited silently, and then continued to answer all the questions she had for it. When she was done, Volyova decided that she could profitably use one of the slugs in her clip. She shot the display. The great glass globe shattered into a billion icy shards, Sunstealer's face disrupting in the same explosion. Curie and Pascal took the circuitous route to the clinic, avoiding elevators and the kind of well-repaired corridors through which drones could easily travel. They kept their guns drawn at all times and preferred to blast anything that looked even vaguely suspicious, even if it later turned out to be nothing more than a chance alignment of shadows, or a disturbingly shaped accretion of corrosion on a wall or bulkhead.
Did he give you any kind of warning he was going to leave so soon? Curie asked.
No, not this soon, I mean. I thought he would try it at some point, but I tried talking him out of it. How do you feel about him?
What do you expect me to say?
He was my husband. We were in love.
Pascal seemed to collapse then. Curie reached out to catch her. The woman wiped tears from her eyes, rubbing them red.
I hate him for what he's done. You would as well. I don't understand him either.
but I still love him despite it. I keep thinking, maybe he's dead already. It's possible, isn't it? And even if he isn't, there's no guarantee I'll ever see him again.
It can't be a very safe place he's going to, Curry said, and then wondered if Cerberus was any more dangerous than the ship now.
No, I know. I don't think even he realizes how much danger he's in, or the rest of us.
Still, your husband isn't just anyone. It's Sylvestre we're talking about here.
Curry reminded Pascal that Sylvestre's life had been shot through with a core of rare luck, and that it would be strange if that fortune should desert him now, when the thing that he had always reached for was almost within his grasp. He's a slippery bastard, and I think there's still a good chance he'll find a way out of this.
That seemed to calm Pascal, fractionally.
Then Curry told her that Hegazi was dead, and that the ship appeared to be trying to murder everyone else left aboard it.
Sajaki can't be here, Pascal said. I mean, he can't, can he? Dan wouldn't know how to find his own way to Cerberus. He'd need one of you to go with him.
That's what Valjova thought.
Then why are we here?
I guess Ilya didn't trust her convictions.
Curry pushed open the door which led into the clinic from the partially flooded access corridor, kicking a janitor rat out of the way as she did so. The clinic smelt wrong. She knew it instantly.
Pascal, something bad has happened here. What is it I'm supposed to say at this point? Cover you?
Pascal had her low-yield beam gun out, without looking like she had much idea what to do with it.
Yes, Curry said. You cover me. That's a very good idea.
She entered the clinic, pushing the barrel of the plasma rifle ahead of her. As she moved in, the room sensed her presence and notched up its illumination. She had visited Valjova here after the Triumvir had been injured. She felt she knew the approximate geometry of the place. She looked to the bed where she was sure Sajaki ought to have been. Above the bed floated an elaborate array of gimbaled and hinged servo-mechanical medical tools, radiating down from a central point like a mutated steel hand with far too many fingers, all of which seemed tipped with talons. There was not a single inch of metal which was not covered in blood, thickly congealed, like candle wax.
Pascal, I don't think...
But she too had seen what lay on the bed below the machinery, the thing that might once have been Sajaki. There was also not a single inch of the bed which was not adorned in red. It was difficult to see where Sajaki ended and where his eviscerated remains began. He reminded her of the captain, except here the captain's silver borderlessness had been transfigured into scarlet, like an artist's reworking of the same basic theme in a different and more carnal medium, two halves of the same morbid diptych. His chest was bloated, raised above the bed, as if a stream of galvanizing current were still slamming through him. His chest was also hollow. The gore pooled in a deep excavated crater which ran from his sternum to his abdomen, like a terrible steel fist had reached down and ripped half of him out. Perhaps that was the way it had happened. Perhaps he had not even been awake when it did. For confirmation of this theory, she scrutinized his face, the little of his expression she could decipher beneath the veil of red. No. Triumvir Sajaki had almost certainly been awake. She felt Pascal's presence not far behind.
"You shouldn't forget I've seen death," she said. "I saw my father assassinated.
You've never seen this."
"No," she said. "You're right. I've never seen anything like this."
His chest exploded. Something burst out of it, at first so efficiently concealed by the fountain of blood that it had disturbed, that it was not obvious what it was, until it landed on the blood-slicked floor of the room and scampered away, worm-like tail lashing behind it. Then three more rats elevated their snouts out of Sajaki, sniffing the air, regarding Curry and Pascal with matched pairs of black eyes. Then they too pulled themselves over the caldera which had been his ribcage, landing on the floor, following the one who had just left. They vanished into the room's darker recesses.
"Let's get out of here," Curry said.
But even as she was speaking, it moved, the fist of steel fingers, activating with blinding speed, reaching out to her with a pair of its clawed, diamond-tipped digits, so quickly that she could only begin to scream.
The claws snagged her jacket, ripping into it, and then she began to pull away with all the strength she had. She wrenched free, but not before it had located a purchase around her gun, dragging it with brutal force from her fingers. Kuri fell back into the mess on the floor, noticing how her jacket was soiled with Sajaki's blood, how at least some of the brighter red pooling from the rips must have been her own. The surgical machine elevated the gun, cradling it for them to see, as if gloating at its acquisition of a hunting trophy. Now two of its more dexterous manipulators snaked into place and began to examine the gun's controls, stroking the leather casing in eerie fascination. Slowly, ever so slowly, the manipulators began to point the gun in Kuri's direction. Pascal raised the beamer and blasted the whole assembly, blood-caked metallic chunks splattering over Sajaki's remains. The plasma rifle crashed down, blackened and gushing smoke, bluish sparks dancing from its shattered casing. Kuri picked herself up, oblivious to the filth in which she was liberally covered. Her ruined plasma rifle was now buzzing angrily, the sparks dancing with increased ferocity.
"It's going to blow," Kuri said. "We have to get away from here."
They turned to the door, and then had a second to adjust to what was now blocking their exit. There had to be 1,000 of them, piled 3 deep in the ship slime, each individual careless of its own life, but acting for the greater good of the whole senseless mass. Behind, more rats, hundreds, and then thousands more, piling back along the corridor, a vast, rodent tidal wave, brimming at the aperture of the clinic, ready to surge forwards in one consuming tsunami of appetite. She unsheathed the only weapon she now had left, the tiny, ineffectual needler she carried only because of the precision it allowed. She began to squirt it at the mass of rats, while Pascal doused them with the beamer, which was hardly more suited to the task. Rats exploded and burned wherever they pointed their guns, but there were always more of them, and now the first rank of rats was beginning to creep into the clinic. Brightness flared down the corridor, followed by a series of bangs, spaced so closely together that they almost merged into a solid roar. The noise and the light came closer. Rats were flying through the air now, propelled by the approaching explosions. The stench of cooked rodent was overpowering, worse than the smell which already pervaded the clinic. Gradually, the wave of rats began to thin and disperse. Volyova stood in the doorway, her slug gun belching smoke, its barrel the color of lava. Behind them, Kuri's ruined weapon grew suddenly and ominously silent.
"Now would be a good time to leave," Volyova said.
They ran towards her, trampling over the dead rats and those still seeking shelter. Kuri felt something slam into her spine. There was a wind, hotter than any she had known. She felt herself lose contact with the floor, and then for a moment she was flying.